He has filled the hungry with good things, but has sent the rich away empty. And he said, truly, I tell you, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Just a few more. So the tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but beat his breast and said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. Be completely humble and gentle. Be patient, bearing with one another in love. So that's my non-referenced stroll through the biblical witness, a very, very selective bunch of texts dealing in one way or another with humility, which is the topic of this lecture tonight. These are some of the least ambiguous passages in the Bible. If you think of texts in the Bible, some of which are very, very clear, much of which is very, very clear, some of which are difficult to interpret, but these are ones that are not that ambiguous. Humility is indispensable to knowing God and indispensable to being in a right relationship with God. It's only through humility that any of us can receive the good news of the gospel, through humility. So it's really, you could say, that the essence of the Christian life. It's the key. If there's a key, it's the key. And yet, I find it's very difficult to talk about, and I think people share this. I find it difficult to stand up and give a lecture on humility, right? It's an odd thing to do. I think it's particularly difficult to practically define, as in, what should it look like in my life? What does living humbly look like? What would a humble response be in various different real-life situations? I think we can find it easier to talk about humility in negative terms. To be humble is to not be proud. And that's helpful to a degree, I think. If we think of all the ways in which pride is connected with blindness and self-deception, inability to see God, inability to see ourselves as we truly are, humility is the opposite way of life, and it has the opposite results, has the opposite fruit. So to be a humble person is to see clearly, where to be proud is to be blinded. To be a humble person is to view ourselves truthfully as who we really are, to see God for who He really is. And to grow in humility is really a stripping away of the self-deception of pride. That's what humility is. To grow in humility is to have the self-deception of pride stripped away, and it's to grow clearer and clearer in our vision of reality. So to refer to humility in negative terms is helpful up to a point, but it still doesn't necessarily help us understand what it means to live humbly day in and day out, what it looks like practically. And one of the challenges that we face is this. Whenever we contemplate to what degree we have humility, we hit a roadblock. Because on some level, humility by definition has to do with how we perceive ourselves. It's a particular view of the self. Whether I am humble or not has to do, to some degree, with what I think about me. What's my attitude towards my own gifts? What's my attitude toward the role I play in the world? My motivations, my words, my thoughts, my actions. Humility has to do with my attitude towards these things. And yet, most of us know sort of instinctively that while humility is a view of the self, it's impossible to be humble if we think too much about ourselves. Self-forgetfulness seems to be essential to humility. Over-analysis of ourselves usually is a departure from humility. So many of us feel convicted, rightly, that we ought to live humbly. It's something we're just recalling all these biblical passages about how you must humble yourself before the Lord. Don't approach Him with pride. We ought to live humbly, but are we supposed to monitor our growth in this area? Is that even possible? How do we know if we are on the right track towards humility without taking note of our humility and taking pride in it? and generally just becoming self-obsessed. What does success in humility even look like? And what does it even mean when humility at its core is really an acknowledgement of our weakness and our failure? So to me, these are difficult questions that you can kind of get into a never-ending tailspin thinking about them, which to me maybe is an indication that it's the wrong direction to go in. I think if humility is alive in us at all, it is so when we are not thinking about it. It's one of the shy virtues, in a sense, that disappears as soon as we look directly at it and analyze it in ourselves. So maybe it's a virtue that we only grow in by setting out to do other things. And it does not actually and cannot thrive under analysis. The key might be instead to strive for obedience and truthfulness. This is something I'm hoping to, unless I change my mind about this idea, I'm hoping to flesh this out more in the following lecture. But humility is something that we approach if we, instead of thinking about our humility, think about being obedient to God and then truthful. Because if obedience to God and then truthfulness about our failures to be obedient to God, if those are our genuine goals, then humility is likely to be the result. If patience is the goal, if love for other people is my goal, if adoration for God is my goal, and then honesty about my failures in all of these areas, which I will fail in these areas, humility will be the result by God's grace. So anyway, that's kind of the general direction that I'm hoping to go in part two, but tonight is part one, and I want to instead talk about what Christian humility is not. I began to realize, originally I was planning on doing one lecture on humility, as if that was a good idea. And I started realizing that I'll do a section at the beginning of that lecture about all the things that humility is not, because there's a lot of misunderstandings about humility, and it soon became clear that this is going to be one of these four-hour lectures that you all dread. So I broke it up into two, and tonight we're really focusing on the negative tonight. Those things that humility is not. There are many things we call humility and strive to achieve that really are not humility by Christian standards or by biblical standards. The term false humility, I think that's something that's familiar to most of us. We talk about false humility. It usually means a very particular thing to us, but I'm sort of wanting to broaden it to talk about false humilities, because there's different ways of misunderstanding humility, and I'll be talking about a couple of them tonight. So the task tonight is to identify some of the ways in which we misidentify humility and create false humilities. And this is not just a discussion about semantics. This isn't us getting together to define humility correctly and then go home. I think there's real practical reasons for puzzling through this, because when we have a misunderstanding of a virtue, like humility, we will set goals and expectations for ourselves in the Christian life, which are unnecessary and potentially really unhelpful and harmful to us and other people. We'll be heading away from the true virtue and towards something else. If we have a misconception of what humility is, we'll strive towards a way of life that God actually isn't calling us to, which will always lead, I think, to confusion and disillusionment with ourselves and with God and with our faith in Him. So God calls us to a way of life which is actually hard enough. And we will fail at the task of being obedient to God. But if we're going to fail, we want to fail while striving to do in the right direction, right? We don't want to fail while heading in the wrong direction. We want to fail towards the right things. And our God is merciful and loves us and accepts us even when we fail. But we want to be heading in the right direction, as Paul talks about in Philippians, striving, pressing on towards this goal that Christ is achieving in Him. So we should avoid, I think, burdening ourselves with wrong expectations about what the humble life should look like. And so my hope is this lecture might be a freeing sort of word tonight. Because the definition of humility is a disputed thing. In the modern liberal West, the humble person behaves and speaks and thinks in particular ways. And we have to ask ourselves, if we're Christians, if we're actually looking to the Bible for our wisdom here, is this the humility that God is calling us to, or is it something quite different? Christian humility is a distinctive kind of humility, I think, that might not be recognized as a virtue by people who aren't Christians, necessarily. So notions of humility that do not come from the distinctive promises of God in the Bible are not likely to be Christian humility. There's a specific reason why the lecture is not just titled What Humility Is Not. I'm trying to get at what Christian humility is not, because I'm trying to point to ways in which it's actually different than the world around us may define that virtue. And so I thought of, and also it's not just about sort of the secular world out there and how they define humility. There are many misunderstandings and false humilities within the church that have been nurtured within the church for many years. And so that's, many of us have probably experienced some of these things. So I thought of three basic areas of everyday human life in which humility is really important. It's important in all of life, but these are just three ways of three sort of categories. And those are humility about our accomplishments, humility about our moral failure, and humility about our knowledge. So this is just a basic outline for tonight. That's where I'm going. And really what I want to get at is that these three areas are often where we get mixed up about humility. Our accomplishments and our agency in the world, our ability to choose and make decisions that affect the world around us. And then, secondly, our moral failures, our sin. And then lastly, what we can claim to know, our convictions. And our attempts to be humble in these areas can sort of backfire, and then we wind up with confused notions of that. And so really what I'm talking about is this, the false version of all those things. And I think it'll probably become at least somewhat clear what the true version of those things might look like. I hope, anyway. So while our efforts may be very well motivated and may very well start from the position of really true teachings from the Bible, they can get off track. It's like they take a detour and then get lost and end up going in the wrong direction towards a false destination. So, firstly, false humility about our accomplishments. This is what is most commonly called false humility, I think. We'll start with something that's probably familiar to lots of us. And I'll start with a sort of a silly and very insignificant little story. I have a friend who's a Christian man who, along with a business partner, started an organization called Waypoint Adventure. And they run programs that get young people with physical and developmental disabilities outside. And hiking and rock climbing, kayaking, snowshoeing, and they partner up with local schools and afternoon programs and whatnot. Things that many of their clients who have disabilities might never otherwise be able to do. And getting them places where they otherwise would never go. And my friend is very committed to enabling people to exceed their expectations of what's possible for themselves and to have adventures in the outdoors, which is, you know, usually not available to people with physical disabilities. A few months back, we had a dinner party at the Chestnuts and with some other friends also, and I was gushing a little bit to this friend about how awesome I thought his work was and how great an idea this was and how life-giving and transformational and important this organization, Waypoint Adventure, is. And he said something which in many Christian circles would be strange. He said, "Thanks, Ben." And which was the appropriate thing to say, but it was also an unusual thing to hear sometimes if we're in Christian circles, right? In Christian circles, sometimes we get a very different response when we try to encourage each other or praise each other's efforts, right? Instead, we hear things like, "Praise God, it's all His doing," or different versions of this, maybe not in these exact words. "Well, thanks, but it's not really me, it's all God, I'm just, I'm a vessel. Well, it's not really about my gifts, I have an awesome team." Even if we don't hear these words explicitly said, I suspect these kinds of attitudes are implicit in sort of the awkward, like, foot shuffling kind of responses that we get when we encourage each other. So, and my hunch is also that we might be speaking to meet what we think other people's expectations are of us, of what a humble person should say, right? Or try to downplay our own achievements whenever it's possible. And part of this, I think, is understandable, of course, and well-motivated, because our intentions might be starting in the right place. It's clearly not good to have an inflated impression of our own gifts and accomplishments. So pride in these areas, I think, is a real risk, and it dishonors God, and it actually separates us from God. If we claim in any way that we have done anything independently from God's constant care and sustaining power, then we're lying. We're lying to ourselves, we're deceived, and we're guilty of pride. So let's imagine, this is a hypothetical, let's imagine that I'm a very good soccer player, and I act as if my achievement on the soccer field is solely a result of my own strength and hard work and discipline and raw talent. I would be forgetting that every breath is an intentional gift from God. That's one thing I'd be forgetting. A body that works as it should is a gift. A world in which there is a consistent law of gravity, for instance, that's also a gift. A society which is stable and prosperous enough for me to have the leisure to play soccer is a gift. Parents who encouraged me rather than discouraged me when I was playing on the town team as a kid. All these things are gifts. And all this is true. We don't do anything in our own strength, really. We're the recipients of sort of incredible number of blessings that we can't even count. But is it therefore true that I have nothing to do with my abilities on the soccer field? No, I have a lot to do with them. I practice hard. I paid attention to my mistakes and learned from them. I listened to my coach's critiques. I stayed late after practice. I went, I played games every Saturday growing up. All these things that, this isn't actually true of me, but this is. I've worked really hard at this. Right? So, which is it? Another example. This one is a true story. Another friend of mine named Tom, he was leaving church and was sort of shaking the hand of the pastor, as we do after a service. And Tom said to the pastor, "That was a really excellent and helpful sermon. Thank you so much." The pastor said, "Well, that's something like, well, that's all God's doing, isn't it?" And Tom said, "Really? Do you mean to tell me that you didn't prepare for the sermon at all? You didn't study during the week? You didn't reflect on the passage and read what other preachers have to say about it?" And the pastor says, "Oh, well, all right. Yes, I did, when you put it like that." So, Tom says, "Well then, thank you. That was a great sermon." "Okay, thank you," said the pastor. I'm not sure that's exactly how it went, but... Now, what's going on here? What's happening? Was Tom trying to inflate the pastor's ego by saying, "Good sermon, Pastor"? Was he out of line there? Was he tempting the pastor to pride and away from humility? I don't think so, right? I don't think you guys are chuckling, so I sense that you're with me here. I don't know. Of course, no sermon does any good at all unless the Holy Spirit moves in the people listening. So the reason Tom had the response he did was because the Holy Spirit was alive. He heard something in that sermon. So that's true. And of course, no pastor preaches a good sermon in his own strength without the Holy Spirit revealing things to him or her. And yet, many pastors actively apply their wills for hours and hours and hours every week, wrestling with the meaning of a passage, wrestling with how to best communicate this to a congregation, given the particular needs and issues of the congregation. So their efforts are not illusory. And the same is true for any endeavor. This isn't just about preaching, obviously. This is about any endeavor. Our efforts are not illusory. Our labors actually matter. So we're kind of bumping up against one of the great mysteries of the Christian faith, which is the mystery that affirms both God's sovereign control over everything and the reality of our choices. It actually matters what we do. And another way of putting that mystery is that we are utterly dependent creatures who have real dominion. So yes, God uses us, but he also calls us to participate in a real way in the coming of his kingdom. So we're expected to actively make ourselves available for his use. So when we say we are used by God, we should actually resist kind of simplistic images in our mind or metaphors like a lifeless tool in the hand of a workman or something like that, or a limp, empty glove waiting to be filled by the Spirit of God, which animates us to do his will. These images actually don't do justice to the complexity of it. They don't do justice to the reality of our dominion as human beings. So, what about the awkward responses to compliments or encouragement that we sometimes hear in Christian circles? I think it is appropriate both, and necessary actually, both to honor God in our accomplishments and to say, praise God, and to accept thanks and encouragement offered to us from other people, both. Not in a way that inflates us in pride, but in a way that acknowledges that we have worked and somebody noticed it. I don't feel that is a intrinsically dangerous and prideful and hazardous thing to do as Christians. The two are not at odds. Honoring God, without whom nothing is possible at all, and then saying thank you when somebody encourages us. I'm going to read a passage from the Screwtape Letters, which I considered reading the whole chapter, but this would take too long, so I'm going to read a chunk of it, which is most applicable to the topic tonight, but I encourage you to go and read the whole book, but this is chapter 14 from the Screwtape Letters. And the Screwtape Letters, it's important to understand in the context of this, everything is stated in negative terms. This is a letter from one demon to another demon, giving him sound advice as to how to corrupt a human being and lead this person away from God. And so everything that's good by God's standards is bad by Screwtape's standards. Everything that's bad by God's standards is exactly what Screwtape wants. So everything is flipped on its head. It's important to understand that before you start reading the Screwtape Letters, that you may be very disturbed. it's disturbing enough already, actually. So the Screwtape Letters, this is C.S. Lewis and Screwtape talking to his nephew, Wormwood. And actually, I have it on the screen. You must therefore conceal from the patient the true end of humility. Let him think of it not as self-forgetfulness, but as a certain kind of opinion, namely a low opinion, of his own talents and character. Some talents, I gather, he really has. Fix in his mind the idea that humility consists in trying to believe those talents to be less valuable than he believes them to be. No doubt, they are in fact less valuable than he believes, but that's not the point. The great thing is to make him value an opinion for some quality other than truth, thus introducing an element of dishonesty and make-believe into the heart of what otherwise threatens to become a virtue. By this method, thousands of humans have been brought to think that humility means pretty women trying to believe they are ugly, and clever men trying to believe they are fools. And since they are trying to believe, and since what they are trying to believe may, in some cases, be manifest nonsense, they cannot succeed in believing it, and we have the chance of keeping their minds endlessly revolving on themselves in an effort to achieve the impossible. And this is typical of the way Screwtape talks. He's not trying to make arguments to deceive anybody. He's just trying to confuse the person and get them spinning around inside their head infinitely. Because he's got nothing actually to teach anybody. He's just trying to confuse people. So, anyway, I think we see, and you know, if we read this in terms of the negative image of what Screwtape is implying, what Lewis is implying here, God loves the truth. It does not honor him in any way to deny that he's given us gifts that he really has given us. That's not how we honor God. Or to downplay their value. There's all kinds of biblical passages here that we could refer to. I'm thinking of the parable of the talents, where, I mean, none of these servants would have had anything to invest at all if the master hadn't given the talents to them. And yet, they were expected to do something with it, and they were actually judged accordingly when he came back. The whole game wouldn't have happened if not for the master's initiative, but their responsibility mattered. And it mattered a lot, if you read the whole parable. It's also, in the context of false humility, it's hard to know what "well done, my good and faithful servant" means exactly. I'm not going to get into that, but that's just another thing to reflect on. I think there are two things going on with some of these, some of what I've been talking about here. We're trying to distance ourselves from our own gifts, relinquishing all the claims to them, really for fear of being prideful. And then secondly, we're trying to deny the reality of our own agency in the world, that we really have a choice in the world, and we're not just puppets on a string. And I think this is a theme that has emerged for me as I was preparing for this lecture that comes up again and again. False humility is false because it always in some way rejects a gift from God. And I think that's one of the, if there's any thread that ties this lecture together, that's the thread. False humility is false because it always rejects a gift from God. Usually it comes from not accepting the full biblical account of reality, or the full story of who we are and who God is and what He's done. And when we leave parts of the story out, we tend to reject gifts that God has given us. And I think this is really at the root of false humilities. In this particular case, we've been talking about our falsely humble denials that we have talents or we have any agency in the world, our rejection of the gift of dominion, this creational thing. We have been given the ability to meaningfully affect the world around us, to order and subdue creation. This is the beginning of Genesis, very close to the purpose and meaning of what human existence is to be like God and having some dominion. Obviously, a very limited creation, creature sort of dominion, but nonetheless, dominion. It's one of the things that differentiates us from the animals. And individuals exercise their dominion in an incredible diversity of ways, depending on what their particular gifts are. And that's something that we're called to as individual followers of Christ to reflect on. Our dominion is not something that we are called to relinquish or deny. So humility is not to be found in denying that we have gifts, nor is it to be found in viewing ourselves as, like I said before, limp puppets waiting to be controlled. This is really a rejection of dominion. Rather, I think... let's see if I actually do this. That's what I just said right there. I think maybe the direction to head into, to head towards, to grow in humility is actually found in a process of acknowledging that we have gifts, actually, saying, oh, that was a gift. Because if we actually pay attention to the fact that we're calling it a gift, it implies a lot, right? We didn't invent it. We're not the source of it. It was given to us. If it's a gift, it was given. And so we need to reflect more on the word itself and the concept. Accepting that we have gifts and then thanking God, the giver of those gifts, without whom we would be nothing at all. We could not do anything at all. This is an intrinsically humbling experience, to say thank you, to discipline oneself to say thank you. It is admitting that we are not self-sufficient. And then putting those gifts to use. God doesn't just give us gifts to go and enjoy in a corner. He gives us gifts to use for the furthering of His kingdom with all of our strength, knowing that God is working in us. And so again, this is what I think Paul is getting at, the type of thing he's getting at in Philippians 3, where he talks about pressing on to take hold of that for which Christ has taken hold of him. Christ took hold of him, but it's still Paul who's pressing on. And he can strive as hard as he does because he knows God is in him, working in him. So these two things are not mutually exclusive, our striving and God working in us. They're really mutually, there's resonance between the two. I'm going to move on to the second major section here, false humility about our moral failure. What does true humility look like in the context of our sin? Humility is clearly called for because we fail morally. We fail to live up to God's standards of how we should live. And honesty before God about our sin is really our only hope. This is, if you read Psalm 32, King David is in a place of utter despair and disintegration until he confesses his sin to God. And then God becomes his hiding place. And if you think back to the verse I read earlier about the publican, the tax collector who's beating his breast outside the temple, he doesn't even approach the altar or wherever the Pharisee is standing. this is a similar thing. He's being honest about his sin, and he's the one that goes home justified. The Bible teaches us that We have all fallen short of the glory of God and have sinned and continue to sin, which alienates us from God. We have not lived as we should, as one of the Anglican confessions go, in thought, word, and deed. That covers a lot. And the Bible calls Christians to repentance, to be actually convicted of their sin and to turn away from sinning and turn back to God. So it's not just about feeling bad, being remorseful. It's about turning and making an effort to change. It is supposed to bother us that we have rebelled against God. So far, so good. But I think there's a common attitude that many of us struggle with, and it goes like this. And this is something that's there's a lot of autobiography in here for me. This is something that I've struggled with. I think my hunch is many people do as well. But there's an attitude that goes like this: God could not possibly forgive me, or the gospel is the truth for everyone except me. It's good news for the world, but not to me. My sin is so grave and so serious and so uniquely twisted that I am beyond the reach of God's forgiveness. My inability to break free from particular patterns of sin in my life disqualifies me from receiving God's grace. It is for people who have made lesser mistakes than me in their lives. I am too unlovable for God to love. Even if we never articulate this in words, my hunch is that many of us secretly feel that this must be true. That the gospel applies to everyone except myself. And we are somehow uniquely disqualified from God's love. I think maybe every Christian experiences this at some point in their life. This feeling that this is great news. I wish it was for me. The atonement could not possibly apply to me right now in this moment of shame and guilt and self-disgust. We still feel condemned despite our theology of God's forgiveness. And the disturbing thing to me is that this attitude can pose as humility. It can pose as humility in the face of our moral failures. It can pose as an appropriate sort of remorse for our sin. We can tell ourselves things like, I know I'm being humble if I just feel miserable enough about my sin. My inability to believe in God's forgiveness for me means that I must take holiness very seriously, which is a good thing, right? But this attitude, I think, can pose very well as humility, but it's actually not Christian humility at all. It's an understandable place to be in sometimes, and I'm not saying that this is you're lost forever if you've thought this. I've thought this before, but this, what you're experiencing when you feel that the blood of Christ couldn't possibly apply to you, that's not what the Bible tells us humility is. Remorse for our sin is not a destination for Christians. It's not a destination place. This is not where the gospel leaves us. Conviction for our sin is actually just the bad news about ourselves that makes the good news so good. So the story continues, and any notion of humility has to reflect the rest of the story as well. Like I said in the beginning, if we're talking about Christian humility here, we need to tell ourselves the whole story. Our sin has been paid for and removed from us. The guilt of it has been removed from us. As far as the east is from the west, which is this wonderful image of it's not even really a distance. It's so far that it's not even really a distance. It's a direction. Two directions, as far as one is from the other. Through the death and resurrection of Christ, we have been radically forgiven. And not just forgiven, but reinstated as sons and daughters of God's family. Even in our present ruinous state, God the Father views us as having the righteousness of Christ. It's one of the things that being in Christ means. The righteousness of Christ is credited to us, and God sees us in that light now. We're called again and again, particularly in Paul's letters, to live into this new state that is ours, to start behaving like the new creations that we already are in God's sight. To accept what Christ has done for us, and then live in light of it. And This is the rest of the story that we sometimes have difficulty taking seriously. But this is equally a part of the Bible's account of reality, right? We need to take the whole story together. Like we saw earlier, what makes humility false is that it involves a rejection of one of God's gifts. And here we can see it clearly. I think to say my sin is so severe that God could not possibly love me is a rejection of the work of Christ on the cross. As not enough, somehow, for me. It's a rejection of God's solution for our deepest problem. It's to say that our sin uniquely is too difficult for God to deal with. And it's a refusal to accept the status, the new status that God has given to us as children of God. Christian humility heads in precisely the opposite direction, I think, from this. It demands an acceptance that what God says is the case is actually the case. Regardless of where we may be feeling emotionally, regardless of how self-condemning the voices in our head happen to be. If we do not accept that what God says is true, we're not being humble. So this kind of false humility is very often disguised pride, I think. And I want to get into that in a little bit more depth. It is disguised because it looks like grief at sin and it looks like a longing for holiness. But really, it is to say, essentially, I know better than you, God. God says that the blood of Christ is sufficient. I say it's not for me. So there's this weird irony to it. It looks like I'm deeply concerned about my sin. I'm deeply struck and convicted. And yet, what I'm really doing is refusing to believe what God has told me is the case. It's actually to resist one of the main works of the Spirit, which is to convince us that the blood of Christ was effective. This is Jesus sending the Holy Spirit to be His advocate to us, convincing us that actually what Jesus did worked. And it's actually to believe the voice of the accuser, which is Satan. This is the type of thing that Satan convinces us of and tries to convince us of all the time, that the love of God does not reach us. And what's at the root of all this? Why in the world would we not want to accept that God's great rescue plan has actually worked for us as individuals? And I think there's a whole bunch of possible answers for this, and I'm just going to take a stab at a couple here. It comes from different attitudes that are very deep in us. For some people, I think there's a twisted sense of status in feeling unforgivable. My sin is unique, uniquely perverse. All those nice-sounding promises in the Bible are pretty naive. They actually only apply to the goody-goodies in the world, the people who are basically prudish, who've made minor mistakes and feel really bad about them. Paul, Jesus, Isaiah didn't take me into account. me and my really, really, really bad mistakes, my bad behavior. My story would make Paul blush, wouldn't it? I bet. So there's this weird sort of pride that we can actually take in this, in feeling rejected and feeling unforgivable. And it's absurd. I'm not saying this is what everybody goes through. I think this is something that some people maybe struggle with more than others. We might be a little deflated to discover that most other people in the world are just as screwed up as we are. Actually, maybe we're not as unique as we think. We may need to learn the humility that, you know, of acknowledging that we are not uniquely bad, maybe. You remember when Paul calls himself the chief of sinners? He says this in large part because he used to hunt down Christians and arrest them to be executed for being Christians. So he's pretty bad. None of us could probably boast that in our resume. And yet no one is more convinced than Paul of his new status in Christ. He calls himself the chief of sinners. He used to persecute the church. He used to persecute Christ. And now he is more convinced than anybody of his new status in Christ and the totality of his acceptance by God. He knows it. Another attitude at work. That was number one. Number two, forgiveness and grace is okay for all those other people who really need it. But I'm living by a higher standard than that. I shouldn't need that kind of charity. I should be capable of living the life that pleases God in my own strength. There's been very, very few people would articulate this. in words, but this is something that maybe a lot of us think sometimes. I should be capable of living the life that pleases him in my own strength. Now, if that's the case, then there's really only two options available to us. It's either live a perfect life and perform to earn God's acceptance, or fail utterly and be beyond the reach of his love. If that's the standard we're living under. But of course we do fail terribly, and we screw up badly, and we're left with only the second option. We feel that forgiveness in our case is just totally impossible. Not because holiness is so important to us, but because we never thought we needed forgiveness in the first place. And we'd rather reject it than admit that we needed it all along. But we really thought that God would hold us to a higher standard because we are better than everybody else. That's why God would hold us to a higher standard. And that's why we're so disappointed in ourselves now. And that's why we think we're beyond forgiveness. Is that humility? No, it's pride. This is just an example of human pride at work. A third example, this is something that maybe I've struggled with the most of all these things. Very often our attitude towards God's forgiveness is resting on whether or not we feel able to forgive ourselves. And it's really dependent on whether we can forgive ourselves for something. The two are just completely conflated, God's forgiveness and my forgiveness of myself. We don't seem to have much trouble feeling forgiven by God when our sin doesn't bother us too much. If we can forgive ourselves easily, or better yet, not even be troubled in the first place by what we've done, said, and thought, we can easily imagine a God who smiles down on us. An illustration of this, I mean, I can sit on a bench at the mall and make condescending and superior comments about everybody who walks by. Right? Any of us could do that. And because my own conscience isn't really disturbed by that behavior very much, because I am, in a sense, shameless about this, about just sitting and judging people who walk by who I don't even know, I have no trouble conceiving of a God who can forgive these sins, because they're little, insignificant things. They're, as Dick has said, they're within the circle of permissibility. There's permissible sins, and all that stuff is okay. It wouldn't take much for God to forgive me for those things, really because they don't bother my conscience much. But if I do something which, in my own eyes, is shockingly bad, say if I commit adultery or get in a drunken brawl somewhere or do something which makes me feel ashamed, it can feel nearly impossible to bring these things to God. These things stay in the dark. They stay unexamined. They're unconfessed. They're unforgiven. And God remains a forgiving God, but only up to a point, only for the little stuff, but not for this. And I think this attitude is really odd because it implies that God can only forgive those sins for which I have an easy time forgiving myself. Those moral failures that I basically view as being permissible. In reality, I should have been much more disturbed by the wrongness of my little sins, because they're not little. To sit and judge people as if you are sitting in a place of superiority is not a little thing. It's actually quite a bad thing, a serious thing. And I should be more comforted by the enormous capacity of God to forgive me for what I perceive as being the big, horrible thing. The thing I can't even stand to think about, let alone confess to God. He will forgive me for those things if I come to him. So maybe we confuse God's own forgiveness for our own feelings of being forgiven by ourselves. And so his forgiveness seems unreal to us when we cannot forgive ourselves. And this is essentially making God in our own image, if you think about it. He is only as full of grace and love as I am myself. And our only hope is that God is much more full of grace and mercy and love than we are ourselves. Much more able to forgive than we are. So, if this is what's going on in my head when I say, I have sinned so badly God could not possibly love me, it's not really humility at work in me, is it? Because my own assessment of myself trumps God's assessment of me. That's what's going on in all these examples, actually. What God says is the case is secondary and dependent on what I say is the case. God's ultimate appraisal of me through Christ is rejected in favor of how I feel about myself. And at its heart, again, this is pride. Rejecting the gift of God's forgiveness is not Christian humility. Humility in the face of our sin, I think it does require confession. But then it requires something even more difficult for some of us, and that is believing God's good opinion of us right now. Believing that however we feel about ourselves, God approves of us right now through the mediation of Jesus Christ. In Christ, God's evaluation of us is good forever. Humility then really has to do with getting on with the difficult task of believing God. Believing what he says is the case. Of giving his opinion about me more weight than my own opinion about me. Moving on to the third section here. False humility about our knowledge. And this is sort of a different kind of discussion here. But one that I thought I would include in this lecture. The previous two areas of false humility, I think, have been around for a long time. Denial of our gifts and our agency, which kind of downplays our dominion. And denial of the efficacy of Christ's work for us, which rejects God's forgiveness ultimately. There have probably been versions of these kind of misunderstandings for centuries, and they, in various times and places, have been nourished within the church. But this last one, I think, is both more contemporary and more of a secular misunderstanding of humility. It certainly flourished in the liberal postmodern West, but has been picked up by some extent and embraced by many Christian people. And it goes like this. True humility is to have and maintain an attitude of agnosticism towards all religious knowledge. True humility is a deep reluctance to assert any particular belief with conviction, or to make any strong claims about ultimate reality at all. To have certainty and conviction about anything in the area of religion, God, ultimate meaning, is to be deeply arrogant. To say, this is so, about God, is intrinsically a failure of humility. The humble person, within this understanding, the humble person knows that no one can possibly claim to really know anything with any real certainty. So conviction in belief is an inappropriate thing. Of course, you can get away with conviction as long as it's relativistic conviction. In other words, as long as you are really, really passionate about your beliefs alone at home, privately. Don't attempt to communicate those as if they apply to anybody else. So conviction is great as long as it's totally subjective, private experience for you. But to express conviction of your beliefs is a failure of humility. When speaking, the humble person might begin by saying, you know, I could be wrong, but... and they may end with the words, yeah, but who really knows? this is the attitude we're supposed to have if we're going to be humble in the world today. At the core of this kind of humility is uncertainty, but it's not an uncertainty that is seeking greater certainty. It's an uncertainty that is valued for its own sake. It's a lack of conviction, not as a provisional stance until we understand more or gain more knowledge. It's a lack of conviction that's actually a virtue in and of itself. It's actually the heart of this humility. I'm just going to call this the humility of no conviction. And that'll come up again. This is not just an attitude held by sort of liberal theologians and radical postmoderns. Many people in the church, I think, have a deep reluctance to speak with conviction about anything at all. This is particularly true, I think, when we speak to friends who are not Christians and who are suspicious of our faith. I've certainly experienced this pull. In an attempt not to seem arrogant and off-putting, it's very tempting to speak about our faith as if we're just kind of figuring it out as we go along, as if we're just on a journey of discovery like everyone else in the world. As if our beliefs are true, but true for us, or have been helpful to us, and that's why we believe them. We're desperate to not come across as superior or judgmental to the person who does not share our belief. And the conversations actually will go much more smoothly when we talk in this way. It's true. There's a reason why it's a temptation. Even if we really do believe in the God of the Bible and put our trust in Christ, it's easy to slip into talking as if we held these doctrines very loosely, because we want to be thought of as humble, but by the standards of the person who we're talking to, their standard of what humility is. But are we speaking with Christian humility here, or some other kind of humility? Is it the humility of no conviction that we're aiming for? Sometimes it is, I think. Is this really the stance of a humble Christian towards knowledge? And as with the other examples, I think there is some truth in this. Or at least this kind of attitude could come from the right motivations, I think. Human knowledge is very limited. Firstly, there are things each of us do not know about God, about the Bible, about how to live, about the world around us, and about other people. All of us are ignorant about all those things in many, many ways. We may be able to learn more about each of these things, so it's not as if that knowledge is permanently inaccessible to us. But the fact of the matter is, right now, we are ignorant of a great many things. That's just a fact. And Christian humility calls us to admit this. One of the reasons maybe why there's this notion of, I mean, we can't blame it on this alone, but Christians pretending they're certain of absolutely everything actually maybe is what's encouraged this other view of humility, that it, you know, we have been guilty of arrogance. So we as Christians, we are called to admit when we don't know things. God never calls us to pretend we have certainty that we don't really have, or when we don't have a clue. The words "I don't know" are underused by us, when very often they're the only honest thing we can say. There are also things that we cannot know by virtue of being limited human beings. There are deep mysteries that I never expect to be able to explain fully. Psalm 131 is one of my favorite psalms, and it's very short and profound. The psalmist says, "My heart is not proud, Lord. My eyes are not haughty. I do not concern myself with great matters or things too wonderful for me. But I have calmed and quieted myself. I am like a weaned child with its mother. Like a weaned child, I am content. Israel, put your hope in the Lord, both now and forevermore." And this is a wonderful picture to me of actually what human maturity should look like. The metaphor is of a child, but it's of a weaned child, not a nursing child. So it's a picture of maturity. It's a maturity that enables the psalmist to rest in the knowledge that he cannot know some things. He stops straining and tugging at God's sleeve, which is what unweaned children will do. He's stopped expecting total certainty and answers about everything, and he can stand, you know, the image is of a child standing by the side of its mother without tugging at her sleeve to be breastfed. That's what being weaned means. The psalmist has stopped expecting total certainty. He's okay with the fact that there are some things that are too wonderful for him to comprehend. Thirdly, of course, for many people, Christian conviction is not yet possible, and it's not yet appropriate. So that's another caveat here. A lot of people are honestly trying to figure out what they believe, and it would be wrong for them to feign convictions that they don't yet have. And this is where a lot of the Brief students find themselves, I think, when they're here and asking questions and addressing doubts that they've had. People who honestly are seeking answers to their questions but haven't found them yet are not guilty of this kind of false humility that I'm talking about. That's not what I'm talking about at all. All this is true, and yet I think we still need to reject the humility of no conviction as basically a secular imposition on the way we think as Christians. It's not Christian humility. Christian humility needs to include the possibility of deep conviction. Uh, If we reflect on it more, it's clear that if humility is going to be distinctively Christian at all, it depends on deep convictions about the nature of reality. Christian humility is a particular response of conviction to particular teachings in the Bible. We have to be convicted of those teachings if we're going to be humble. If the Bible did not teach me that there's a God of infinite power and creativity who made me and sustains my life in every moment, I would very likely have hugely inflated ideas about my own importance, my own independence. I would nurture delusions about myself in my mind. If I'm going to bow to God, my Creator, which is really the only truthful thing I should be doing, I have to be pretty deeply convicted about the doctrine of God and who He is. I have to believe that what the Bible teaches me about that God is real. I have to believe that I am not God, with real conviction. If I'm wishy-washy on any of these things, and if I am reluctant to embrace conviction about these things, I'm not really going to come away a humble man by the Bible's standards of humility. The same is true regarding our sin. Unless I'm deeply convicted that what the Bible tells me about my fallen state is really the truth, I'm not going to think about myself as a sinner in need of God's mercy at all. It's easy not to think of ourselves in that way. Most people in America don't think of themselves in that way. And yet, this is a crucial insight that I have to have if I'm going to be humble by biblical standards. I need to take my sin seriously. Without that insight, though, I could easily justify all my bad behavior and blame other people and blame my upbringing and all these other things, all the ways in which we rationalize our sin. The publican beating his breast outside the temple was not suffering from a lack of conviction. That his humility was not a lack of conviction type of humility. He was deeply convicted of certain truths, God's holiness and his own brokenness. And in light of these convictions, he was humble. And therefore, he went home justified by God. So, Christian humility depends on beliefs held with conviction, I think. It is conviction acted out, in a sense. The humility of no conviction is actually, again, another form of pride, I think. It is to be committed to remaining uncommitted, no matter what new information I receive. To be committed to remaining uncommitted on principle. Kevin Van Hooser addresses this issue from the perspective of biblical hermeneutics. He's talking about the interpretation of texts in the Bible. This is taken from a book he wrote a number of years ago called Is There Meaning in This Text? And he's addressing the question, can we really say that the author's intention, say one of the biblical writers, their intention is carried by the text and is available to us, the readers? Can this text carry the meaning and intention of the author to me, the reader? Or does the reader inevitably bring their own reading to the text, effectively eliminating the author and their intentions? The death of the author, it's called. And he describes the latter view as a kind of literary skepticism, that actually we can't, you know, there's no such thing as meaning that's conveyed in text. It's all what we bring to a text. And I'll quote him at some length. He says, just how confident can we be as interpreters that we have discovered the meaning of the text rather than ourselves and our own projections? The short response is to say that our knowledge must be tempered by humility and that our skepticism must be countered by conviction. There are two sorts of responsibility in interpretation. A negative requirement, not to exceed one's epistemic grasp and claim knowledge that cannot be known, and a positive responsibility to make the effort to know what can be known. There must be recognition of givens and limits. The morality of literary knowledge demands both. If we are to live this tension, we must avoid absolute knowledge and absolute agnosticism alike. To be an interpreter, which is our vocation as humans and Christians, is cause both for dignity and for humility. We can know, but not as God knows. So he's arguing that the task of interpreting the Bible, and actually in any text, actually, is to discern what is unknowable and what is knowable. And our response to the former should be humility, where we should be humble in the light of things we cannot know and do not know. And our response to the latter should be conviction. If there's something we actually can know with any confidence at all, conviction is an appropriate response. And he goes on to talk about the sins of the interpreter are two, pride and sloth. This is interesting. This is the very end of a very, very long book on hermeneutics, which I haven't actually read. I just read this last chapter. So. comes highly recommended. But anyway, he says, when he's talking about pride, he says this. It encourages us to think that we have got the correct meaning before we have made the appropriate effort to recover it. Oddly enough, it is possible to take pride in one's skepticism as well as in one's certainty. Indeed, it is sometimes hard to tell the two apart, particularly when the skeptic insists that one cannot know anything. And then about sloth, that's the first deadly sin of the interpreter, that's pride. The second deadly sin is sloth. Whereas pride claims knowledge prematurely, sloth prematurely claims the impossibility of literary knowledge. Sloth is another name for what Kierkegaard called the aesthetic stage of existence, the way of the unconvinced and uncommitted. Specifically, interpretive sloth leads the reader to forego the effort of attending to the text. So if we don't really believe there's any meaning that's being conveyed in a text and that the author's intention is being carried to us through a text, we don't really need to make an effort to figure out what the intention was. The assumption is we're just bringing our own meaning to the text, and that's okay, and that's all that we can do. And so, in a sense, he's accusing this is a sloth of sorts because we're not making the effort to find out what it really means. Which he's very honest about what his perspective here. He's saying there actually is a meaning in the text that can be conveyed from author to reader, and it's our responsibility to try to find out what that is. So let's see here. The problem of sloth, I think, is something that Van Hooser claims is a problem both among theologically liberal people and theologically conservative people. Both pride and sloth, he says, they're bipartisan sins. In conservative circles, sloth takes the form of simply believing what someone else tells you about a text. The preacher on TV, whatever, he just, well, that's what it says, that's what it is, kind of thing. That is a danger within conservative circles. That's how sloth manifests itself very often. And then this is what he says about sloth in among liberal circles. He says, instead of working towards the best interpretation, they remain satisfied with a plethora of conflicting, often contradictory readings. Interpretive sloth thus ignores the voice of the other every bit as much as does interpretive pride. So Kevin Van Hooser is discussing theories of hermeneutics and interpretation of the Bible, but what he's saying really applies more broadly to what I'm talking about also, to Christian belief in general. To choose to stay unconvinced and uncommitted is not really humility. To refrain on principle from having convictions is not a humble thing to do. Every Christian is called to be honest about what they cannot know and what they do not yet know. But at the same time, every Christian is called to affirm with confidence those things that we can know and do know. So what is the good gift that this kind of false humility rejects? Remember, each kind of false humility rejects some gift of God. And in this case, I think the humility of no conviction rejects God's revelation. The infinite personal God has made himself known to us. He has. Through the Bible, through his Son, Jesus Christ. Comprehensive knowledge of God is not available to us. Complete clarity about every biblical verse is unrealistic, even for brilliant biblical scholars. But meaningful and true knowledge of God is available to us. And we're meant to affirm those things with conviction and order our lives around those things. So this has been, I think, one of the roles of the creeds of the church. These concise statements of Christian doctrine, the essentials of Christian doctrine, protections against heresies at different times in church history, but also something that congregations stand up and say together, we believe this and this and this and this. This is a way of reminding ourselves that conviction is important. We're supposed to be convicted of certain truths, and it's not by escaping conviction that we will reach humility. So I want to conclude now. I feel like in some ways, looking back, this lecture is a good analogy for this lecture is clearing brush, clearing a bunch of brush and weeds and junk before we can see what the ground actually looks like, before we can build anything. You have to clear everything out of the way first. And I hope to, next time in the next lecture, look more... more fully at what humility actually is rather than what it is not. But I think we're starting to get a sense of what it might be and what it might look like just by reflecting on what it's not. And in closing, I want to just reiterate the importance of telling the full story. If we want to aim for true humility, we need to reflect on and accept the fullness of the biblical account of reality. The full account of who God is, the full account of who we are and who He says we are. When we emphasize one aspect and downplay another, we'll end up with distorted beliefs and we'll also end up with distorted goals. If in an attempt to be humble about my achievements, I deny the reality of my God-given dominion, I'll be telling myself only part of the true story. And my goal of humility will be a distorted one. I'll be heading for the wrong target in life. If in an attempt to be humble in the face of my sin, the work of Christ seems to not be good enough for me, then I'm not telling myself the whole story. And I'll actually be rejecting the gift of God's forgiveness. And I'll be falsely humble. And finally, if in an attempt to be humble about the limits of my knowledge, I adopt the principle, sort of a principled lack of conviction, I'll be pushing away the gift of God's revelation. He actually has told me something about who He is, and it can be trusted. So in each of these three examples, there's nothing really humble about rejecting that gift from God, each one of those gifts. His dominion, His forgiveness, His revelation. To reject those gifts doesn't make me humble. Humility, I think, in contrast, is closely tied to accepting and receiving the gifts of God, and that's hopefully where we'll be heading if all goes well. But that's where I want to end tonight. And at Libri, we always open it up for discussion or comments or questions. And if you need to leave, you should feel free to do that, or stretch your legs, that's fine too. At this point, we're just going to talk for a while, and then some point or other, we'll decide it's over. But, yeah, any questions or comments? Yeah, Richard.
Thank you, Ben, for a good introduction to the subject. I'm looking forward to part two someday. Maybe a good day. I do have a couple of observations. One has to do with the problem of, I guess, humility about God's forgiveness of our sin. And I guess I would say that there's something besides pride that could be an issue there. And that is if you have, I guess, a damaged ability to love yourself.
Sure, yeah.
Which can happen in certain kinds of broken families.
Yeah.
That you don't get enough positive input from your parents or from whoever should be giving that.
Mm-hmm.
And you can end up damaged in your ability either to love or to trust.
Yeah.
So when Jesus says, love your neighbor as yourself, that assumes that you love yourself.
Yeah.
And if you're having trouble loving yourself, you're going to have trouble loving your neighbor also.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's also implied a difficulty in trusting.
Yeah.
And so maybe it's not even a problem in trusting God, but maybe it's a problem in trusting the people who tell us about God.
Yeah.
Okay, maybe this pastor doesn't realize how bad my sin is.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't realize that God really wouldn't forgive me.
Mm-hmm.
He just thinks that. You know, it could be an issue of trust and self-love.
Yeah. I think that's very true. I mean, that's one thing that's probably one of several things that I did not mention as other obstacles to really believing in the forgiveness of God and the love of God.
I wanted to bring that up just in case somebody here is struggling with that.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, some people do struggle with that, and it can be overcome, but it's not the same problem as Christ.
It's not. Yeah, it's not. I agree with you. I'm really glad you mentioned that. I think that though, even in that case. I mean, it's a different sort of journey that person is on, in a sense, in that their journey is to maybe deal with a lot of their past, deal with family issues that were really troubling and damaging to them, in order to be able to believe that God's love and forgiveness is a reality. You're right; it's not the same thing as just being prideful.
It's a problem of being healed.
Yeah,
which is different from the philosophical issue. Mm-hmm.
Even in that case, we could say that self-hatred is not humility either. It's not pride, but it's also not humility. It's self-hatred is the damaged self. We're not supposed to hate ourselves, actually. It may be for all kinds of reasons out of a person's control, and it's not their maybe depending on how they've been treated.
Human mind is a strange thing.
Well, yeah,
it's hard to account for all the possible causes. Yeah.
But can you agree with me that that self hatred is not a goal for Christians, and it's not actually that's not what humility is.
That's not what humility is.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm with you there.
Okay. No, but I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's very true. I wouldn't want the lecture to imply that anybody who has difficulty accepting the forgiveness of God is just prideful. Yeah. Yeah, Thomas.
Well, just about self-hatred. Even though, obviously, we're not supposed to hate ourselves, but yet we are supposed to hate the sins that we have. Hate all sin, even others, let alone ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
In a sense, there's a hatred. It's even brought out in Ezekiel 36.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't say hate yourself, but I really hate him. But what's wrong in us?
That's true, but I mean it's in a sense we're supposed to view ourselves as God views us, which is he's appalled by our sin, but he loves us deeply.
Yes.
A helpful distinction again and again, which is the difference between worthiness and worth. Because none of us are worthy. We're unworthy of God's love, but that's the whole point. He loves us not because we deserve it, and he's forgiven us not because we deserve it. So we're unworthy, but we are of great worth to him.
And he has made us worthy to become inheritance of the saints in life.
Mm-hmm.
Not that we can say ourselves, but
we say he's
made us put us in that position.
I think that's what is what's meant by Christ's imputed righteousness to us.
Mm-hmm.
We've been made worthy. It's not that I no longer sin right now. I do, but if I'm in Christ, God sees the righteousness of his Son. Imogen. That's a very good, a good point. I guess what I mean when I say conviction of sin, or being convicted of our sin, is it's only a good thing if it's actually sin that we're convicted of. Mm. If I feel ashamed of all kinds of things which aren't actually my fault. Mm. For instance, maybe we've been abused as a young person, and I can be deeply ashamed and hate myself for that. Is that my fault? Is that a result of my sin? No, it's something that I've suffered. So it's really, I think, maybe very difficult, but it's important to distinguish between what are things that are really sin, and what are things that are just things I suffer shame for, which actually maybe are not connected to guilt. I mean, there's a difference between guilt and shame. When I talk about it's good to be convicted of our sin, I'm talking about things we've really done in rebellion against God that in order to see God and grow in self-understanding and receive the forgiveness of Christ, we need to acknowledge those things. But it's not about going around and hating yourself for every decision you make in life, because very often the two, guilt, which is really a moral failure, is confused and mixed up with things we're ashamed about but aren't really a result of our sin. So I don't know. I guess it just, you just to be very careful about what we mean when we say that. And I think that I'm talking about conviction of sin when it's really unambiguous.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the people I know, that is the conviction that they feel terrible about.
Yeah.
But,
yeah. I mean, people hate themselves because of how they look.
Mm-hmm.
People hate themselves because they don't have this gift that someone else has. I mean, and that's not what conviction of sin is. There's all kinds of really sad and unnecessary self-hatred that we have.
Mm-hmm.
Tom?
To that point, isn't there 2 Corinthians 6 or 7 maybe, has that phrase where it says, sorrow according to God leads to repentance without regret.
Yeah.
And sorrow according to the world leads to death.
Yeah.
What she was saying sounds like it's sorrow leading to death.
Yeah.
Where the conviction was not having the result.
Mm-hmm.
So I question whether the conviction was
I mean, I think I think one of the things that passage means is that you're, well, if I'm not looking at it right now, but you know, feelings of guilt for our sin and remorse and conviction of our sin, it isn't actually intrinsically a redemptive thing. It's only redemptive if we then turn, ask God for forgiveness and repent.
Right.
That's the only way in which this actually has any redemptive purpose. Feeling guilty, I mean, lots of people feel guilty their whole lives, and it's not a good thing. It's not a redemptive thing. It doesn't lead to anything life-giving, like Paul was talking about there, the repentance of these, I forget exactly what it says.
But it's not for enough, I can pay for my own sin.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, feelings of guilt are only a good thing insofar as they lead us back to God. And if they don't do that, then they're of no use at all. They lead us away from God. And so, that, you know, there's nothing intrinsically righteous about feeling terrible or remorseful. You can feel really terrible about yourself without ever making an effort to change or to ask for forgiveness. Dave.
Yeah, I started thinking in the moment 7, Paul is giving us some help here because he's slamming on his own sin. The very good that I want to do is I can't do that. I can just feel like you think he's a hopeless case. He's the one who got me civil war. And yet what he's doing in that is he's saying God and I both agree that my behavior, thought word and deed, is really lousy. And so he's slamming his sin. He and God both are slamming his sin. But then he goes and say, but I, in my inmost self, am with God. In other words, I'm standing on God's side of this, disapproving of my sin and my behavior, and it's his way of getting back and establishing his own, in a sense, value and worth and where he's standing. He's not just a complete loss and a catastrophe. He's got this alien power of sin at work within him that's picking him up at every turn. And he's aware of this, and that's what, in a way, you see in the Psalm 32 that once David recognizes his sin and admits it, then he's, as opposed to hiding it from God, then it's no longer clobbering him, then he's free from it. God is a refuge for him.
Yeah.
And he starts, by the end of the Psalm, he's teaching people how to behave properly.
Yeah.
You know? So in a way, it's a direct confronting your own sin with, as God sees it, is a way of not letting that sin define who you are.
Yeah.
But to live in the relationship you have with God,
yeah,
that stands above it.
Yeah. No, that's very, very helpful. Because that whole passage, which is, like you said, internal civil war going on, ends with, but thanks be to God. You know,
yeah.
This is the end of that passage is celebration,
yeah,
for what He is in Christ.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I find it incredibly comforting what Hebrews says about the blood of sheep and goats could not deliver a person's conscience, but the blood of Christ can. So when we're aware of our sin, it's, and Schaefer used to say in his True Spirituality book, the core of true spirituality is learning the practice of basically appropriating the finished work of Christ for me now, moment by moment, existentially. So that Christians should live with a clear conscience.
Yeah.
We have what the blood of sheep and goats couldn't do, which is as we're aware of our sin and bring it to God, and even since we're not aware, we know Christ has covered it. That means, I mean, as long as God brings an awareness to me that, whoa, I really hurt somebody, well, I need to be reconciled to that person. I maybe need to write a letter and ask forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
I need to go and say, I'm sorry, I hurt you.
Mm-hmm.
But insofar as we, appropriate the death of Christ for me now, we ought to be living not the way Imogen is describing, trying going around feeling guilty around it, but rather Jesus paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to go around guilty.
So it's not just a freedom from sort of punishment for our sin, but it's a freedom of free conscience.
A free conscience,
which to me that maybe is getting at something of what I'm trying to get at here, which is. You know, feeling still as if we're unforgiven, but in humility, accepting what God says is true,
yeah,
over and against my own feelings of self-condemnation, and growth in Christian spirituality has to do with that lag time being less, in a sense, being able to play it right now and to be free of it right now, rather than, gosh, I still feel miserable. And yes, Jesus forgave me, and yes, I'm forgiven, but gosh, I still hate myself for that. You know, which I think is a place where most of us are.
And I mean, Shaver does make here, like I mentioned, there may be time, we may have become aware of something, I need to do something about it.
Right.
I need to ask forgiveness from somebody, or I need to try to build a bridge or whatever, you know. But my guilt can be gone because of Christ.
Yeah.
And then I can have a clear conscience, moment by moment. It's an incredible gift.
Here.
I think you hinted at this a little bit with your comment about it being a shy virtue, but and this may go more to your next lecture, but do you think humility might be an elusive sort of search and pursuit, sort of akin to like trying to be a cool person without getting specifics of like what you actually do, right? Like there's like, it's kind of this like vague condition that to even search for is just you miss the point. The connection I was...
If you say you're cool, you're just... already not cool.
Yeah, yeah. what made me think of this, I was listening to Tim Keller's Practical Grace series, not the whole thing today, but one of it is on patience, and he makes a point talking about, you know, you need to take pity on somebody, and one of the ways you do that is you break down the impulse to distance yourself from another person, saying they're not like me. You make the comparison, you sort of say, look, I'm very similar.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we're listening to this, I thought that it seems that maybe the way to produce or to achieve the humility is if we're seeking after the fruits of the Spirit, because that seems to, if we're going about those the right way, that then produces some sort of humility.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard for me to think of somebody without even having an idea of what the definition of humility is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, think of somebody who is loving, kind, forgiving, you know, all those
things,
who is not then also humble.
Right, it's almost a precondition for all of those.
Yeah.
Yeah, all,
and,
yeah.
And all that's a long-winded way to, like, do you think that it's even worthwhile to search for humility as a condition, as opposed to just simply
yeah.
seeking other more specific things?
That's a really good question. I think that's something I'm still puzzling through. But my hunch is yes. My sense is what I was saying in the beginning of the lecture of stop analyzing your humility levels, and strive to be obedient to God, and all the fullness of what that means, and then honest in the context of that, of our failures, and that is actually, you know, we stop. There's a wonderful, I think it's Tim Keller, but he might be quoting somebody else, where he says, "What's the mark of a humble person? How do you know a humble person when you see one? It's their interest in you." So it's not so much what they think about themselves and how they talk about themselves and whether they think, you know, think rightly about themselves, and whether, you know, it's that they're not thinking about themselves. They're genuinely interested in you and who you are and what's your story and how could I serve you. And that's just something that Christians are called to, but that's a sign that humility is at work. But if they're constantly taking their humility pulse, then something's wrong. Something's fallen off the... So it is something that's I think good to recognize and emulate in other people, but hazardous to monitor in ourselves, because this shouldn't be our concern. Our concern is to seek God and to be obedient to Him, and then be honest in every aspect of what that looks like. Albert, give me.
I guess my question is, like in some of the stuff that you were in the Bible passages you were reading before you started, you know, there's like expressed, you didn't humble yourself, so God calling you to like humble yourself kind of as an action.
Yeah.
Like you need to do X.
Yeah.
But then, you know, another part of your lecture makes it seem like humility is like a undergirding attitude for everything else, and not really a do this, right? So it's like in the beginning, it's like God is judging you for not doing this, and now it's like the contrast of it's an attitude, not necessarily a humble action. But then God slams Pharaoh to say, "You didn't humble yourself, therefore." Yeah. This is what happens, or you humble yourself now.
It depends, I guess. Yeah, that's a good point. I guess this isn't answering your question, but just backing up a little bit, there's a difference. This is something maybe I want to try to look at for the next lecture. It's fascinating. There's humbling yourself, and then there's being humbled by God. And what there's, in other words, there's actively and of your own choice, bending the knee and saying, you know what, I'm not God, and you are God. And that's what humbling yourself means. Yeah. I mean, in the context of Pharaoh, that's totally what it is. Pharaoh thinks he's God. I mean, kings in the ancient world have, you know, are semi-divine personages. That's how they viewed themselves. And God is saying, really? And then let's, in a sense, that's one way of reading the plagues. And be like, who is God? And who is not God? And Pharaoh is refusing to humble himself. And so Pharaoh is going to be humbled by God. So everyone's going to be humble someday, right? It's a matter of whether we bend our knee willingly or whether our knee is bent. I think it depends what humbling oneself means, I guess, because I don't think it's just some one-time act. It is a shift of his entire perspective on who he is, which would be a whole life attitude.
So, would you say it's an action and an attitude, or like not either or, but kind of both? Or I guess because at some point, maybe it's like high pride moments. You know, you should probably like, I don't know.
Yeah, but I want to say it is an attitude which manifests itself in our actions and our words, and external demonstrations of humility that aren't an expression of something real in here. It's not humility. I mean, yeah. we So, yeah, any other insights there? Mark, did you have to?
I'm trying to find this quote. It's a fabulous quote by Iris Murdoch, the philosopher Murdoch, on what humility is. And I can't find the quote. You can actually quote some Iris Murdoch.
Absolutely.
But it's something like, you know, it's not a quality like having an inaudible voice or something, but it's a kind of brutal respect for reality.
It's the quote, so
I didn't get it exactly right.
If
anyone can find Iris Murdoch's book.
What page is that on, Elizabeth? It's also an attitude which demands action at times.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an attitude that is comfortable with being a creature.
Yeah.
And that means you've got to be, you're ready and willing to obey God when He says to move.
Yeah.
And so sometimes it's an attitude that you lose if you don't act. You know, you're being defiant to you, and you're thumbing, you know, thumbing your nose at God and saying, kiss off, or whatever. and if you don't act, because sometimes action is absolutely demanded.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not playing a part, attitude and action.
No. Yeah. It's fascinating. One of the passages I read in the beginning was the one line from Belshazzar's feast, where the hand appears on the wall, and I believe this is the son of Nebuchadnezzar. I think it's Nebuchadnezzar's son, Nebuchadnezzar, who did not humble himself before the Lord and was forced to become like an animal for in the wilderness, eating grass or whatever, and then finally did humble himself. Finally, was humbled before the Lord, and then his son Belshazzar is giving his big feast for his dignitaries. Rolls out all the gold that he stole from the temple in Jerusalem to entertain his guests, and praises the gods of gold and silver and stone and all these things, and then this writing appears on the wall, which is, you've been found wanting, and you have not humbled yourself. This is an example of, I think, at least in Nebuchadnezzar's case, that the painful and long process that it takes to become humble. But in a sense, God being merciful with him, teaching him a very hard lesson. Yeah. Richard?
Somehow that makes me think of Naaman the Syrian.
Yeah.
Who needed healing. And he went to the prophet, and the prophet, was it Elisha? I forget now. Said, okay, just go down and you dip yourself in the river.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't like that idea. He wanted to have to do something really excruciating. You know, take the Argonaut and find the silver outline, and then that would be good enough to heal him. And as a matter of fact, he had to do something, but it was something that was not heroic.
Hmm.
And he thought that was below his dignity to do something not heroic.
Mm-hmm.
And so he basically rejected the gift that God had for him.
But then saw sense after a while, because he thought, what do I have to lose? I might as well just do this. I've come all this way. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. It seems like the prophet is going out of his way to offend the dignity of Naaman. He doesn't even come out to see him. He sends a message, you know, secondhand message about taking a swim in a river. Interesting. Kevin,
I was just wondering if you could elaborate on something you said earlier on in the lecture, just about that we are going to fail sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
When we do, we need to strive and fail towards the right thing. When I feel like a failure, it's just really hard to pick myself up off the ground and start over again.
Yeah.
I was just wondering if you could speak more about that.
Yeah. I guess what I meant was, we just want to be clear about what the Christian life is that God is calling us to, and what are these different virtues that we're supposed to be striving towards, and unless we're clear about what those things actually mean, we're going to be going in the wrong direction. We're going to be striving towards something which isn't right, or something that may be impossible or destructive to us. And I think my point about all these kinds of humility is that they're not, humility before God is not calling me to doubt His forgiveness of me. It's not calling me to hate myself. It's not calling all the things that sort of get confused and called humility. My point there was saying, it's hard enough to live the Christian life trying to honor God in the right direction, heading towards the right virtues. We're going to fall and fail, and that's part of the understanding. We're going to fall and fail, and Jesus Christ has already accounted for that, and so we don't have to doubt our salvation every time we fail. But actually, a confidence in the forgiveness of Christ and the effectiveness of that gives us this amazing, or should give us this amazing resilience to stand up again. And like Marty was saying, we had to have a clear conscience. Christ has forgiven me. God views me now with love and approval because of Jesus Christ. And I can view myself that way too. And I guess that's what I meant was that if I'm going to fail, we're going to fail. We might as well fail trying to do the right thing rather than because I think, and I didn't really get into sort of what the consequences can be of just pursuing some wrong understanding of humility our whole lives, and I don't even really know, but it's not going to be good. Did you want to come back on that?
I wrote that down as well. I love the way you said that. Fail towards the right things. And I can't bring it up a couple of times, but it made me think of the opening of the Sermon on the Mount, where, the Sermon on the Mount is Jesus's, in Matthew, it's Jesus's sort of big multiple chapter talk on what the Christian life is. It's a very difficult, rigorous thing he's laying out. It's not lowest common denominator, but it starts with this, like, blessed are the poor in spirit. It starts with Jesus very aware we're going to fail at all of these things, and that as we try to live this life, we'll find ourselves poor in spirit and needing blessings, and we find ourselves on our knees, and it's like, it's right there at the very beginning. And I don't know, I thought that was a wonderful way that you fail in the right direction, fail towards the right things.
Thanks. Yeah. I mean, there's a difference. I think something I always, those of you who are students are probably sick of me saying this, every time we read the Psalms at breakfast at my house, it seems like I always harp on this idea that there's a big difference between in David's kind of conception, there's the wicked, and then there's the righteous. The distinction between those two is not one of them sins and the other one doesn't. The distinction is the wicked are opposed to God in everything and are heading away from God and in active rebellion against Him in every sense. The righteous love and put their trust in God, but screw up every day. And so he views himself as one of the righteous, not because he's free from sin, but he views himself as one of the righteous because he comes back to God and asks for forgiveness again and again and again. And so he's in right relationship with God because God is merciful to him, and he's, like in Psalm 32, he confesses his sin. And so that's a picture for me of what failing in the right direction is. He's falling on his face, doing bad stuff, and being convicted of it and asking God for forgiveness, but he's headed towards God as he falls, in a sense, as opposed to the wicked who in every aspect of their being are opposed to God and acknowledging his lordship, and refuse to make God their refuge. But that's, yeah.
What a wonderful proverb that actually points to that, where it says, which I find really encouraging, the wicked are destroyed by one calamity. The righteous fall seven times and get up. And so it's so interesting because the righteous are not those who don't fall.
Yeah.
the righteous are those who hope in God's mercy, and therefore, when they fall, they get up,
mm-hmm.
and they're not destroyed by seven calamities. And of course, seven in the Bible is a symbolic
endless.
Seven times seven times seven. So failure is just so not the end of the world. in the biblical worldview, if our hope is in a merciful God who loves us. And I love it. I like to apply that to the parable of the talents, because it's so interesting that the ones who Jesus praised are the ones who risked losing the talents.
Yeah.
It was the guy who said, I'm gonna bury it so nothing can happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was risk involved in investing the 10 talents and the 5 talents. Because you might lose them.
We never find out what the master would have said had he invested them and lost it all.
Yeah,
but the assumption is
they ripped.
Yeah.
And might have fallen.
Yeah.
And who knows? You don't know exactly what happened. But,
yeah.
but the righteous fall 7 times and get up and try again and not destroy by climbing.
Yeah.
That's where their hope is. The wicked hope isn't. It's in an idol,
mm-hmm.
or even not in the true God. So when their hopes are dashed,
mm-hmm. it's or sort of the difference between trusting in your own strength. Mm-hmm. That's really where your trust is. Mm-hmm. When you have no strength, you have nothing left.
Yeah.
And whereas the, I think the picture of humility also, like what you're saying is resilience. Mm-hmm. Being humble actually is a way of being resilient to what life throws at us. Mm-hmm. Anything else for the resurrection? Yeah,
thing,
yeah.
Is it thing I always quote?
That's your own book.
I try and get it right. It's by a guy called William Gaddis, who's a novelist. The most ignominious defeats of all are held in store for those who fail at something that was not worth doing in the first place. So that's
what
you're giving the answer to.
Yeah. Or in many Christian circles, feeling guilty that I didn't succeed at this thing that I shouldn't have been going for in the first place.
Yeah.
And simultaneously, if something's worth doing, it's worth doing poorly.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great
question.
Did you know that, or was that your original? That's good.
I did know that.
We're all just
you didn't reference Chesterton, though.
I heard Jim Fuller quoting
him
today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Peter.
This may be an obvious implication, but I'm curious about your point about false humility about accomplishments. And you mentioned some of the phrase, we'll say, they'll describe their accomplishments and say, by grace of God, or something like that. I'm wondering if, just in general, you think we should guard that use of that phrase a lot more than we do. Because we apply it to a lot of, frankly, trivial situations, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like the weather, or like, you know, travel. And
sort of parking place.
Yeah, you know, and even you can go up a little bit in terms of importance. But we apply it to a lot of somewhat, you know, trivial situations. It seems like we should be thinking first in terms of perhaps that grace of God is that we are, you know, saved and redeemed,
mm-hmm.
and regenerate. And then we can kind of go down there and kind of fit into those levels. But I feel like I connected with what you said, that because I feel like that grates on me a lot when I hear it over and over again, because it becomes a truism to say the grace of God is akin to saying, Lord is the Lord. That could apply to any situation, good and bad.
Mm-hmm.
That's more of more common the question, but it seems like perhaps you just guard the use of that phrase a lot more than we do. We throw it around just very casually, but it should be reserved for purely the most remarkable circumstances.
I'm not sure I'd want to make a rule about that, because everything is by the grace of God is true. But you're right that it can be used in such a way as to become a cliche. And it's something that it's maybe language that we need to protect in order for it not to lose its meaning, because it's very important and very true. So I totally relate to what you said about certain Christian cliches. We hear them so often that they just lose their meaning to us. It's like punctuation at the end of a sentence.
They almost have to take the Lord's name.
Well, right. I mean, if it's said as punctuation and not thoughtfully and reflectively and with meaning and intention, then I think it is taking the Lord's name in vain. But I wouldn't want to say that we should just reserve it then for matters of salvation and not refer to the grace of God in other ways. But I wouldn't want to make a rule of that, I guess. It seems to me it depends a lot on how we use the language, maybe figuring out other ways of saying it that aren't cliche.
Well, like any other thing, it depends on our attitude toward God.
Yep.
Well, picking up on that, maybe oversimplified, the person says it with gratitude and thankfulness, you don't feel like it's a cliche. You know, if it's just a punctuation, it's just... But you can generally tell if the person is saying, wow, what a great to God, whatever. Simple or complicated, they're thankful.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the other side of that though is if different people are affected differently by cliches. Some of us are very hardened, and even the most genuine thing, we're like, oh, give me a break. And so, yeah, I mean, that's as much my problem as it is anything. But yeah, I don't know. I think the grace of God is such an important and central thing that how we speak about it should, in a sense, reinforce that rather than deflate it. Or it's a little bit how I don't know. Never mind. we should say it carefully and with intention. Rather than say, oh, by the grace of God, oh, by the grace of God, you know, because if it is just punctuation, then I think you're right. We're not honoring God with those words because it is so true and important. It actually is a dangerous thing to speak flippantly.
Yeah, and I wonder sometimes that it seems like going to the idea that like there's human agency matters, that saying by the grace of God actually is not engaging properly and thinking about giving due credit to the to the human subjects who've acted in a certain way. Because either they have common grace or they actually have been endowed with, salvific grace of sorts to do that action. But it's sort of like this, it's kind of lazy in some ways to not, give people their credit.
Any other thoughts about this?
I just think a big thing is that we've got to be much more aware and conscious of language. The language is really important. Worship is really important. The Bible tells us that again and again. Death and life are in the power of the tongue. And we just throw language away. I guess Clyde Kilby said the Christian cliche is the Christian mouth on automatic pilot. That's just ghastly. It's just you connect and your mind just tells it, okay, connect with something Christian and out come cliche. and you hear people talk that way.
Yeah.
Not just Christians, but other people too.
Yeah.
We'll send cliche. Politicians are kind of like, it's just cliche. Not all of them. It's a huge devaluation of language, which we have every reason to think is very precious.
Which means I think the difference between a thoughtful word and automatic pilot is that you're actually thinking about it, what it means when you say it, the implications and the weightiness of it when you say it.
And that's why he was saying it really breaks the commandment. Of taking the Lord's name in vain, which means the Lord's name as something very fluffy and light.
Something weighty that's treating it lightly. Priya, you had your hand up a minute ago.
Well, I listened to Tim Keller's Blessed is Forgetfulness recently, and it touches on similar ideas. And it seems like, to boil it down, or the essence is the falseness and the error is focusing on ourselves rather than focusing on God. So even going back to a dysfunctional family, we kind of are focused on, they did this to me, this is where I'm at, suffering because of this, rather than kind of, how can you change that? How God gave you these abilities, or whatever, to kind of look to the positive, or what can I do rather than dwelling down here in the mud? And here I'm in the mud. God can lift me out of that, and maybe already has, but I still think I'm in the mud.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, but turn your eyes to God. And, yeah. And maybe that, turn your eyes to God, maybe that's cliche, but
I think that's I think about that sermon all the time. I think because it's such a helpful articulation of what makes Christianity unique, and I think it's probably the most assigned thing that we ever give to people in the brain. anyway, but the whole thing of Paul saying I'm not judged by any human court. I don't even judge myself. And what he's saying is, because of what Christ has done for him, the verdict is already in, and he is already completely accepted. The case is canceled, and he's free. And that means that he has this incredible freedom to be resilient against people's criticism and his own self-criticism. He's saying, God's evaluation of me through what Christ has done is so final and significant that it trumps my own opinion of myself. I can hate myself, still be forgiven by God. And really what that ends up meaning is that this whole dynamic of the verdict having been given already, the whole Christian life can be a response of gratitude to that, to what's already been done, as opposed to trying to live morally in order to earn some future approval, which we're uncertain of. And so, which is a life of fear and legalism and uncertainty, as opposed to it's absolutely certain and it's already done. And my task now is to honor God in gratitude and live in obedience to Him because of what's already done. And so it's not, but that is so, maybe it's getting at what Schaefer talks about moment-to-moment awareness of forgiveness, and that's what Christian spirituality is to have that reality be real to me in every moment, particularly when I fail or when I feel like I'm in the mud and beyond help. And finding ways to speak that truth to us when other voices are loud in our head. That's one of the reasons why church is important. Having people to speak the truth to you when you have nothing but rubbish in your head. Thank you. I might wrap it up unless there's another hand up through. Okay. Thank you. Yeah.